This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Just final thoughts on that possibility and what it might mean.
Well, yes, even in the United States, depending on how the polling questions are asked, there's a notable split among the U.S. public. By some polls, a slight majority actually saying they think Edward Snowden did a good thing, although most think he should be punished. The fact is that the Chinese and the Russian governments are very suppressive of their own people. They have routinely been violating the privacy through their own surveillance.
Norman, hang on a moment. We're flat out of time, and I do apologize for that. My guest, Norman Solomon, is the founding director of the Institute of Public Accuracy and a KBOO alumni himself. This has been a Cascadia for Monday, June 24th, 2013. Michael McDade engineered the show today. Thanks so much, Michael. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Do you have talents in fundraising, development, or new media? Are you an active KBOO member? Then here's your chance to bring your know-how to the KBOO Foundation Board of Directors. Applications are now being accepted for the 2013 election until midnight, June 28th. To apply, go to the kboo.fm homepage and click on KBOO Board of Directors application.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
This morning we are rebroadcasting an episode of Locus Focus that originally aired in March 2011 about a proposal to turn wild and scenic river corridors in Idaho and Montana into industrialized heavy haul corridors for shipping giant equipment to the tar sands operations in northern Alberta. The equipment was manufactured in South Korea, shipped across the ocean and then up the Columbia River to Lewiston, Idaho, where it would be placed on gargantuan trucks for many torturous miles of travel along narrow, twisty, river-lined roads. The struggle to stop the heavy haul was at its height when this program originally aired. A year later, after intensive grassroots organizing and litigation, ExxonMobil withdrew their applications for permits to ship these loads. Barbara has been spending the past week in Idaho and Montana recording interviews with many of the protagonists in this struggle for a documentary she is producing about the impacts of tar sands development on communities in the Northwest. She learned just the other day that another 9 loads are now being proposed along the same route. So the struggle never ends, but people are more prepared this time around and have several legal decisions to back them up.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. While I've been worrying about melting nuclear reactor cores and fuel rods in Japan, another environmental crisis is brewing closer to home. This morning, we're going to talk about how the industrialized tentacles of the Alberta tar sands operations are creeping across the United States. For the past couple months, a convoy of trucks carrying megaloads three stories high and weighing 650,000 pounds each have been wending their way through the scenic corridors of the Clearwater and Lhoxa rivers in Idaho, over Lolo Pass, and up the remote and pristine byways of western Montana. These trucks are heading to the tar sands pits of Alberta. The behemoth machines are manufactured in South Korea, shipped across the Pacific Ocean and then up the Columbia and Snake Rivers, where they wait at the port of Lewiston, Idaho, for permits to continue on narrow, twisty mountain roads to the destination, one of the largest and most polluting industrial operations in the world. Many people living along this route are not only unhappy with the prospect of transforming the landscape of their pristine mountain homes into a permanent industrial corridor, they've organized and are fighting back. And this morning we'll be talking to two warriors against the heavy haul, Zach Porter, who is the campaign coordinator for All Against the Haul in Missoula, and Lynn Wilahi in Kuskia, Idaho, who runs the website Fighting Goliath. Welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having us.
Good morning, Barbara.
Okay, and that's Linwood. Is the second person who just talked?
Yeah.
Okay, and our first voice was Zach. We've been talking about the heavy haul a few times in this show, and the last time we talked about it, which was back in late October, people were still trying to stop the loads, which at that point were just backed up in Lewiston, Idaho. And I understand there's been a lot of activity on Highway 12 in Idaho and up through to Missoula since then. So what's been going on, and how far are these trucks on their way to Alberta now?
Well, the initial trucks, Barbara, were not headed to Alberta. There were four loads that were approved for ConocoPhillips to transport similar-sized equipment to Billings, Montana, to a refinery there that does receive tar sands oil. And the first two trucks have made it through Idaho and past Missoula with great difficulty, with many violations of their permit requirements. To get from Lewiston just to Lolo Pass for the two loads ended up requiring 34 days.
How long were they expecting to take?
Eight.
That's quite an overrun.
Yes, that is. And they had weather problems, mechanical problems, certainly violated a lot of elements of the requirements of their permit. But anyway, those loads are now east of Montana, east of Missoula.
And have they reached Billings yet? Or are they still on the way there?
Still on their way there. They're in central Montana right now.
Now, they must be on a freeway at this point, aren't they? Or are they still on these back roads?
Still on back roads. They're making very little use of interstate highways given the sheer size of these loads. Without modifying bridges and other highway infrastructure, they have to follow roads that have no overpasses. So it takes a pretty circuitous route to get these from point A to point B.
I was looking at a bunch of maps last night, and I was trying to figure out the route up to the tar sands through Montana once you get east of Missoula. I thought, this is really weird because you could get on a freeway at this point. You don't have to continue to follow these pristine river roads. I hadn't thought about all those freeway overpasses. But it seems like there's another side that makes it just as difficult taking these huge hauls on what are very narrow roads, which were meant for kind of backwoods, back road traveling.
Well, very narrow and winding. A sign here just east of Kuski that says winding road next 99 miles. And that's very true. It's probably the most winding U.S. highway in the country. And for that length of, distance anyway. And so that's certainly one of the significant problems they have. And much of that road is, probably 150 miles of the 174 miles are right alongside two of the original wild and scenic rivers in the country, and they pass through the Northwest Passage Scenic Byway and All-American Road, the Nez Perce National Historic Trail, the Lewis and Clark National Historic Trail, through a wild and scenic rivers corridor. I mean, there are six federal designations of the route through Idaho, and each of those designations brings followers who are opposed to those loads.
Yesterday there was a rally and protest at the confluence of the Columbia and Willamette Rivers here in Portland, and I think it was sort of protesting the future shipments that are going to be coming up the Columbia River past Portland. But I wonder if we can talk a little bit about the whole route that these shipments are taking, where they come from, why they're going this way, and why people in Portland are concerned now.
Well, it comes down to a cost decision, pure and simple, for, in this case, you know, the ExxonMobil, the primary corporation that we're dealing with here, which has proposed 207 shipments up the Columbia and Snake River system to the Port of Lewiston and then along highways for about 1,500 miles to northern Alberta. Rather than make equipment on-site, as has been done in the past, or shipping it from East Asia along established routes that don't involve nearly as dangerous a route or one that is as heavily dependent on the tourism recreation industry and has as many side impacts on the environment, on Indigenous communities and First Nations communities along the route, they've decided to build this equipment again in South Korea. The Conoco equipment was built in Japan, but Exxon in South Korea ship it across the ocean and haul it up this route. And it's headed for the Kearl oil sands development, which is one of the new frontiers of tar sands mining in northern Alberta.
I've been hearing that this is cheaper, this is why they're doing it, but it seems like how can it really be cheaper when you have so many problems in having this first haul, the ConocoPhillips haul, take, what, four times as long to go as it was expected to go? It seems like this is going to be a very expensive route.
Well, we think it's going to be expensive from a number of perspectives, Barbara. For one thing, ConocoPhillips had hoped to make that shipment last August. And you know, now originally it was going to be in June, and there were problems on a particular bridge being repaired. And so then they were going to ship in August, and they found themselves in court, and then before the Idaho Supreme Court, and then in a contested case hearing, and finally they were, you know, hit the road on February 1st. So they have had, you know, it's going to be almost, well, it'll be close to a year from the time they hit Lewiston until they get these modules to Billings. And we're hoping, of course, that other oil companies who are considering this route are going to look at it and say, you know, this just might not be the cheapest route there is. ExxonMobil is now dismantling 33 modules in Lewiston at a cost, they say, of $500,000 each module. They're cutting them in half, basically, so they can travel north and go on interstate rather than come on 12. So this route is proving for them to be rather expensive, too.
Well, there's been a lot of rallying against the route in Idaho and Missoula. And when I was in Missoula last October, that's actually when I really started learning what was going on. I was just aware, like every day I was there, and there's a whole bunch of activities that are happening after I left, but very little was being talked about here in Oregon. How did people find out about this, and what kind of resistance started building up against this heavy haul through scenic corridors?
Well, you know, the resistance began last winter, winter of 2009-2010, which was when the first word about this really started getting out. The public was largely kept in the dark for years while the Idaho and Montana Departments of Transportation communicated with these corporations about their plans. And it wasn't until the winter, early spring of 2010 that word really started getting out through the press. But at that time, groups started coming together, Fighting Goliath, Lynn's group in Idaho, Northern Rockies Rising Tide, and the No Shipments Network here in Missoula, started coordinating the grassroots and putting up a resistance effort to ExxonMobil and the other corporations that would use this route. It was a long shot, it seemed, at first, but that has changed over time. And increasingly, as word has gotten out, folks in the Northwest, not just the Northern Rockies, have taken interest. And that's because this project has serious consequences for those who are concerned for the future of salmon along the Columbia and Snake Rivers, among other reasons. But there are plenty of reasons to be interested in this if you're a resident of Portland or Seattle or any of the other communities in that region. This is an issue that spans our region and our globe. It's an issue that brings and connects myriad of other topics together. And it's an excellent educational tool in that way, too, for people who are looking to link these various issues together. So, you know, gradually through educational events, actions, et cetera, word got out, the movement has grown, and now there are literally thousands of people, and I'm tens of thousands, who are following this closely across the region. And it's become an issue of front page importance, not just here in Montana, but in Idaho, Washington, and Oregon.
And actually, this morning in the Oregonian, it was no longer a front page because our metro section on Mondays is now folded into one big section with the front section. But on the front page of the metro section, there was a very good article about the demonstration yesterday at Kelly Point Park opposing the shipments and the Native organizing, the Native peoples organizing to stop it. So I was very pleased to see that was, and that the Oregonians had a couple other articles in the last 6 months about tar sands, but it was nice to see a demonstration being given such prominent placement in the paper. So it does seem like the work that you're doing is really starting to have some kind of impact.
And when my wife, Borg Hendrickson, first put up her website, Fighting Goliath, you know, our purpose was initially to just inform especially Idahoans about this. And because it, as Zach said, it has been kept pretty much under, you know, cover. And she was amazed at the response she started getting. I mean, just hundreds and hundreds of emails, sometimes, you know, 50, 60, 70 a day. And they were from people in, you know, obviously in Idaho and Oregon and Washington and Montana, but also Canada, lots of them from Canada. We had, you know, a response from Israel, and I remember who from a group that is fighting a oil shale development at the actual site of David and Goliath story. And so, I mean, there are lots of people concerned about this, lots of organizations, and many of these organizations have, you know, membership of, you know, 500 to 5,000. And so when information goes out through, like, All Against the Hall or through Fighting Goliath, it goes to a lot of folks.
Well, I'm talking this morning with Lynn Woodlahi, who you just heard, who is fighting Goliath from Kuskokwim, Idaho, along with Zach Porter, who's the campaign coordinator for All Against the Hall in Missoula. And we're talking this morning about their effort to stop a very, very special scenic corridor that actually, I would say, starts in Vancouver, Washington, Portland, along the Columbia River, even though it's been dammed. But it follows the river, Columbia River, the Snake River, and then through this amazing twisty mountain road that follows Highway 12 through Idaho to Missoula, Montana. Eventually, we plan to continue all the way up to the tar sands in Alberta. And we're talking this morning about their efforts to stop this industrialization of backwoods roads and as part of a larger campaign to stop the tar sands operations in Alberta, which we'll talk a little bit more in a moment. I was thinking, as we were talking a few moments ago, about the things that are happening in the world right now. We see in North Africa and the Middle East this upsurgence of a desire and a fight for democracy. And then in the meantime, in Japan, we're seeing this horrible meltdown, literally and figuratively, of a vast industrial complex of engineering that was ahead of its own curve in terms of the safety didn't quite catch up with the engineering gee whiz of it. And I'm wondering if there's an analogy to what you guys are fighting in the Northern Rockies, both in terms of there being an upsurgence of popular support for democracy and also fighting what I think some people are calling the heart of the monster up in Alberta.
That is really the connecting tissue of all of this. You know, Zach mentioned there are lots of connections from salmon to, you know, possible contamination of the Ogallala Aquifer under 8 states with the pipelines coming from the tar sands and the proposed pipelines, I should say. And so there are lots of these elements. But the really big, big issue that we all should be concerned about is saving our democracy. I mean, when the largest corporation in the world that had $85 billion in net profits in 2007-2008, for example, I see, you know, their schedule, you know, looks like they'll have another $40 billion this year. And when the largest, most powerful corporation in the world decides to come in and take over, they typically just do that. And they buy the state legislature, they buy the governor, they buy whatever they need to buy. And but they're now, at least ExxonMobil, is running into some folks that aren't for sale. And they consider that their land is not for sale either. That is their national forests, their scenic byways, and so forth. And so it's a kind of a new experience for them, I suspect.
And who are all the people that are banding together to oppose the corporate monster?
Lynn, I'll let you speak for your side of the border there, but I mean, this is an issue that spans party lines. And I also want to say, and I'm not about to put our fight here on the same playing field as those revolutions going on in North Africa and the Middle East right now. This is a serious humanitarian and environmental issue facing the Northwest and Northern Rockies and Canada, but we're talking about, you know, two different ball games. However, that being said, as Lynn mentioned, this is a fight for democracy. In the wake of the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, we are up against a corporate behemoth that we will be struggling to put in its place for years to come. And but you know, that being said, this is an issue that spans party lines, as I mentioned. The desire to protect where you live, the quality of the water that you drink, your right to a healthy local economy, and to stand in solidarity with our indigenous partners in this effort. This is something that brings in people from all walks of life, Tea Party or liberal, it does not matter. And so we count a wide variety of people in our ranks.
And how about in Idaho? I mean, I know in Montana, you've got Missoula there as the heart of the center of a lot of organizing. In Missoula, it's definitely a bastion of liberal activism, but Idaho is not quite the same landscape, is it, Lynn?
No, we're not exactly a bastion of liberal thinking, that's for sure. Well, here, of course, we have a lot of local folks, and when I say local, I mean, north central Idaho, Moscow, Lewiston, on up the Clearwater Valley, for whom this is prime recreation area. That is, this is hunting and fishing and whitewater rafting and, picnicking and swimming and lots of kind of Idaho values. And so people are, nervous about seeing some of those values disappear. For example, the permits for these megaloads authorize the oil companies to barricade over 100 turnouts along Highway 12 for their exclusive use 24 hours in advance. Well, if you're shipping one load a day, that means permanently. That means they're going to try to keep people from, the water is rising now in the Lock Saw, and when it hits a certain level, it's like a giant magnet, and whitewater enthusiasts come in from all over the Northwest and all over the United States. Run the rapids of the Lock Saw. And they park on those turnouts, they camp on those turnouts, they pull their rafts out and their kayaks out on those turnouts, and they're going to find them with big no parking signs. And they have a lot of objection to that. And so, that's just one group. So it is a multiply complex kind of set of folks who are opposed to this. And they haven't really seen it in practice quite yet, but most people haven't. But those of us who are monitoring the Conoco loads, for example, and spent a lot of hours on the road at night, really saw what this is about. I mean, when you get a convoy of over 20 vehicles with along and outside of that, you have flashing lights on flagger stations and police cars and the giant load itself and an ambulance. And I mean, over 20 vehicles over a mile long of flashing lights and noise passing by all sorts of U.S. Forest Service campgrounds that lie right alongside the highway. It does not, speak well for the tourism industry in Idaho or local recreationists enjoying their visits to the Lock Saw.
Well, let's talk a bit more about the impact that these convoys are having. And what we saw with the ConocoPhillips convoy that's passing through right now, how much more of an impact do you think that the ExxonMobil convoy that's going to actually go up to the tar sands is going to have? And what happens on those evenings when these trucks are making the trip across these serpentine mountain roads?
Well, I mean, for starters, you know, there are two different ball games here. Four loads going to Billings is a serious issue, but it's nothing compared to the 200 trucks that are scheduled to head up to Alberta, much less the dozens and dozens more that we already know are going to come shortly on the heels of Exxon if they're allowed to move forward with their plan. So, you know, for starters, it's really just the sheer volume of these massive modules. There are communities that hug these roadways. This is Main Street for countless towns through Montana, through Idaho. You know, residents will be dealing with a freight train coming down their street at 2, 3, 4 a.m. every day. You know, most days of the week, most days of the year. And that's a serious impact alone right there. Much less the impacts that Lynn has already discussed related to the tourism and recreation-based economy of our region, which brings in billions of dollars. It is the among the highest employment sectors of our economy. This proposal, you know, is it going to be a job killer for Idaho and Montana? Make no doubt about it. The governors of both states, as well as the corporations, like to tout the handful of jobs that will be coming along with this project, most of which will be coming from out of state, go to out of country workers, and the benefits of which will mostly accrue to these large corporations and Canada in the end. So, you know, there's really a multitude of threats. And, you know, it's a safety issue. As, you know, Lynn mentioned the violations that were committed by ConocoPhillips as they moved through Idaho. They delayed traffic for an hour at one point in Idaho, almost 2 hours in Montana at one point. This is if there was an emergency vehicle on along these roads needing to get to a hospital, there is no other option. These are the only roads for hundreds of miles in any direction. If one of these trucks, gets stuck, as it did in one case, hit a rock wall in Idaho, that could be a life or death situation for someone. So we're not just talking about convenience and the economy here. We're talking about lives on the line, and that's unacceptable. It's unacceptable risk, and we know that we are fallible as humans, and mistakes happen, and they already have, and we don't want to see a BP oil disaster here in our backyard. We can avoid it now if we make the right choices.
Now, in a very excellent book that I've been reading called The Heart of the Monster, which was put together by David James Duncan and Rick Bass with a lot of help from Steve Hawley, who I'm hoping to have on this show in a few weeks, who provided the research. There's a photograph in the first section of the book of a big rig that went off of Highway 12 into the Locksaw River, I think, a couple of years ago, and it was just due to a mudslide or an avalanche that happened, and nothing that could have happened, nothing that the driver did wrong. So there's so many physical challenges, it seems, to taking a normal size rig on that road. It seems like it would be multiplied by the immense size of these modules. And also I was reading that the module's center of gravity isn't quite what they expected it to be, and so they're not really well balanced, and they had to do some extra tamping down to get them on the trucks to head them up to Montana.
Well, there are all kinds of problems with the with these size of loads on these kinds of roads. For example, Mammoet, which is a Dutch company that has been contracted to haul the ExxonMobil Imperial Oil loads, the 207, they've had two major accidents in the last 8 months. They dumped a big load in Indiana, and they dumped a big load in Alberta. When I say dumped them, they tipped them right over into onto the highway, and this was in daylight hours on dry pavement with a nice wide road with big shoulders. People don't, it's hard for urban folks to understand, for example, that US 12 across Idaho along the Locksaw River, in many places is only 22 and 23 feet wide, fog line to fog line, and there are no shoulders. That is, there's rock bluffs on one side and maybe 8 or 10 inches of soft gravel and an 80-degree slope to the river. And, you know, these loads are up to 29 feet wide. And as they go around these curves, they have to, of course, sneak out onto that shoulder that is non-existent. It's quite a challenge for them, and we can, this many loads, there probably is going to be an accident. The other thing people have a hard time grasping is for you know, my wife and me, for example, Highway 12 is our route to everything, essentially. I mean, medical care, groceries, mail. I mean, there's no other road. There's one road through here. You don't take a detour. There are no detours. And so if that road is blocked, it cuts off all transportation down the river. I mean, our closest medical, you know, outside of a life flight would then become Missoula at 140 miles away.
Well, I was actually had a wonderful opportunity to take that road home when I was in Missoula last fall, and I did it partly because I heard it was really beautiful, and partly I wanted to trace the route so I could see it firsthand what these trucks are going to be following. And it's an example, I think, of the circuitousness of the route. I came to Missoula by way of Highway 90, Interstate 90, and it's a longer route. It's probably like about several miles longer. It took me maybe 8 hours, between 8 and 9 hours to get to Missoula on 90. It took me over 12 hours to get home on 12, with a few, well, of course, there's a lot of places you want to stop along the way, but it's definitely a slow road to begin with, and it really impressed upon me the danger of having very large trucks there. And for people who are listening who have not been along this road in Idaho, if you have traveled to the Oregon coast from Portland along Highway 6 or from Salem along Highway 20, you can get a good sense of the twistiness of that road, and just imagine it instead of only being 50 miles long being, what, 99 miles long. Plus, you've got, when you get on the other side of Missoula, I understand the road along the Black River is also not exactly a straight and wide road.
No, and you're headed up over the Continental Divide there as you climb up the Blackfoot River and plunge down Rogers Pass. You know, and this is, you know, from start to finish, it's incomprehensible how this route was chosen. There's, as there should be, there's, you know, plenty of talk about the initial part of this route along Highway 12 through Idaho, but, you know, there are issues every step of the way, and as Conoco demonstrated, and as Exxon is sure to demonstrate, although we're going to do our best to make sure they never have a chance to demonstrate, it, you know, the route through Montana along Highway 200, coming up out of Missoula along the Blackfoot River, the river made famous by Norman McLean's The River Runs Through It, you know, these are the landscapes that define these regions, and were never made for this type of travel. This is not about normal commerce, you know, not about even normal oversized load commerce. This is something completely new to most of America, much less Idaho and Montana, and we could be seeing a lot more of it as the tar sands continue to be developed.
Now, I think I've heard this phrase, the high and wide corridor, and there's what you your groups keep talking about is how this area is going to be industrialized, and I wonder what you mean by that. What would an industrialized corridor look like compared to what is there now?
Idaho Transportation Department initially with the Conoco load said they'd only allow one load per night to be on the highway between anywhere on Idaho 12. And because otherwise, for example, a trucker coming from Missoula to the Port of Lewiston would encounter multiple, you know, stops with these rolling roadblocks. Each load sets up a rolling roadblock, and so some, you know, you have to wait to, you know, till that load can pull off, or they can run you around on some, you know, little turnout or something. And so, if they let one go per night, then there could be, you know, and it takes four nights to get across, there could be up to four of these stops. So a trucker coming from Missoula could lose an hour, you know, or more. And well, in fact, you know, could lose 2 hours or more of travel time. So anyway, they were only allowing one. Well, then, of course, ExxonMobil has 207 loads, and they want to get them over in 1 year or less. So and so now you throw in bad weather and a few other obstacles, and so now they have to send one every night. And so now, you know, for example, somebody living above me on the river could, who was trying to get to the emergency room in Orofino, could encounter two of these stops, not one. And then, of course, at some point, that will probably force regular truck traffic into more daytime travel to avoid that. And, of course, that's going to increase accidents then on Highway 12. So what it looks like is, I mean, you know, if the oil companies had their way, in fact, they wanted to ship two a night, and that way there would be eight on the road in Idaho. at any given night. So it's just, you know, it would be an assault, essentially. That is, every night, if you, you know, depending on where you live, from, you know, midnight till 2 or 3 in the morning, or, I mean, that is, you'd have one of these giant convoys going by with the flashing lights and big trucks and so forth, going by your house or blocking your driveway or blocking your access to medical emergencies. And also, of course, all of our EMTs and forest firefighters and all those folks are, I mean, the EMTs are all volunteers, for example. And so, you know, they have to use the highway just even to get to an accident, let alone transport somebody. So I think, you know, if this were to come about, which I don't think it's going to, but if it were to come about, and there are four more companies already lined up trying to get permits after Exxon, it would change the whole nature of this route. They have trimmed over 500 trees on the Clearwater National Forest, probably illegally. They have raised all the power lines to 30 feet, so they don't have that problem. They've Exxon Mobil, when I say they've paved turnouts and widened turnouts, and it's clear that, you know, they're intending this to be a long-term permanent corridor.
Now, you mentioned earlier in the show that ExxonMobil is dismantling the modules that they have waiting at Lewiston, Idaho.
Yes.
For plans to ship them along more conventional routes, like I'm taking it, like be Highway 84 and
yes.
I-15.
Yes.
So does that make you feel that maybe you're on the verge of having some kind of victory here?
We do. I mean, you know, we have them in a contested case hearing now, and that's going to, you know, obviously take a while to resolve. We still have certain judicial issues that haven't been addressed. And so that when I say we, I'm talking about 13 interveners now. We have, and so, you know, they have all kinds of money. They have all the money in the world, practically. But they don't have any more time than the rest of us. And so they're eager to get those modules up to Fort McMurray and beyond. And so they're sitting there trying to think, what is it going to take? And Montana, you know, they know now they're going to get a lot more resistance in Montana, and so they're kind of covering their bets, I think. And well, there's also a federal lawsuit been filed just last week against the U.S. Forest Service from Idaho Rivers United for not meeting their responsibilities and protecting the Wild and Scenic Rivers Corridor. So I think Exxon and, you know, is starting to say maybe this wasn't such a smart choice. And, of course, we're hoping that other oil companies that are lined up behind them are starting to think the same way.
I would just jump in to say that, you know, just to make it clear, we are fighting this fight currently, you know, for this route, but we will fight no matter what route they decide to take, and it is definitely an initial victory for them to be using a route that's established for heavy truck commerce, like an interstate highway. However, the tar sands are a project that we do not approve of in the slightest, and we will continue to fight this fight until they internalize all of the costs associated with tar sands development and are not making use of Washington, Oregon, Idaho, and Montana for their own benefit in northern Alberta. We do not want to be complicit in that development. So we are fighting this fight first and foremost for the Highway 12, Highway 200, and other routes that they'll be taking up to Alberta. But should they decide to shift all operations to the interstate highways, that's where we will shift our operations to as well. And so we are watching that development closely.
I'm talking with Zach Porter, who's the campaign coordinator for All Against the Haul in Missoula, and Linwood Lahey, who is with Fighting Goliath in Idaho. And so as we've got a few more moments here to talk about this, and you just hit, Zach, on one of the points I wanted to bring up, which is that this is a fight against many tentacles, and you are fighting the tentacle that's going through the Northwest. But how do you see yourselves allying with people in the Midwest and the prairies who are fighting the pipeline that would come down from Alberta and go all the way down to Texas, running the crude oil that would come as a result of all the mining? And how do you ally yourselves with all the people up in Alberta, particularly the First Nations people who are trying to shut down the tar sands operations, period?
Well, we work with all of those folks very closely, and we frequently bring people from those campaigns into Missoula and into other communities along the route to explain that they're just, you know, they're experiencing just one part of a massive fight against the tar sands. The tar sands is a beast that we will be dealing with for many years. It's likely to be developed for decades into the future. Only about 3% of tar sands oil has been developed to date, and the area at maximum build-out could equal the size of Florida. So this is a really incredible scale that we're talking about, and it's hard, I think, to grasp what we're up against. But we, you know, have been given this opportunity here. You know, we never wanted it, but to tackle the tar sands directly. And Albertans in support of the tar sands frequently like to say to us Americans who have been waging these campaigns that it's none of our business. Well, this route coming through the Northwest here has made it our business, just as pipelines coming down through eastern Montana and the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma have made it those residents' business. This is the business of all Americans now. As the largest importer of tar sands fuel, this is a decision that we can make as a nation, whether or not we want to continue to support the worst source of fossil fuels on the planet. And, you know, there's no way to extract this oil cleanly. It is either strip mining or pumping superheated steam into the ground and releasing three times more carbon than any other way of extracting fuel, using four barrels of water for every barrel of oil produced, elevating cancer rates in surrounding communities to levels that are, you know, unheard of for most communities, and rare cancers that most doctors have never seen in their careers. So this is, you know, a fight that we are waging again and closely with people across the U.S. and in Canada. We are in constant communication with people working on other tentacles of this effort, as you described it.
And Lynn, do you have anything you'd like to say as parting words?
Well, I guess the bottom line is, you know, we are poisoning the earth, and consequently, we're poisoning ourselves. And so, I mean, you asked, well, what about Oregonians and what's their involvement? And, well, I guess, you know, as a grandpa, I'd say if you've got grandchildren, you need to get in this fight.
And if you care about salmon and the future of the lower Four Snake River dams and restoring what were the world's most prolific salmon runs at one time, it's all wrapped up in this now. And, you know, we can make those connections now, and it brings it right home. So make, you know, this campaign a part of your daily activism. And, you know, please visit fightinggoliath.org and allagainstthehall.org. Sign our petitions and learn about other ways to get involved.
Well, we've been talking with Zach Porter, who's the campaign coordinator for All Against the Hall in Missoula, and Lynn Mulahi, who is with Fighting Goliath in Kuskokwim, Idaho. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Kibu Community Radio. I want to thank Zach and Lynn for joining us, and we'll stay in touch because I'm sure there's going to be a lot more happening, and keep me on your mailing list for one thing, and we'll talk maybe again in a few months. So thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thank you, Barbara.
We have all the links to their websites as well as more information about a very important book to read to learn about this called The Heart of the Monster by David James Duncan and Rick Bass. And that's all on our website, kibu.fm/locusfocus, where you can also hear this program later on today. Next week, my guest is Dr. Frederick Hirschenmann with the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture and Iowa State University. It's a preview for the Food for Thought conference that's happening in a few weeks at the University of Portland. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. I'm going to go out with some music by Natalie Merchant.
Take one last look behind. Earth has to memory in mind.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, hear Disability Awareness. Host Grace Reed interviews Israel Bayer, Executive Director of Street Roots. And at 11:30, Roberta Hall hosts Health and Healthcare Forum. Her topic is the recent Oregon legislative session and the actions regarding health issues. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Our listeners in Corvallis and Albany will be happy to hear that we have replaced the failed translator and installed a brand new translator. KBOO's new frequency for Corvallis, Albany, and Philomath is 104.3.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
This is Grace Reed. Welcome to our new show, Disability Awareness. It's been renamed. It's an old show that's morphed into a new show at this point, and we're really grateful for KBOO to let us come here and talk about this. Today we'll be talking about poverty, homelessness poverty, and the effect on the community, including the disabled and handicapped, and some solutions. Today's show is the first in a series linking poverty and disability. We'll be doing this for the next through the summer.